since I'm bringing up the rear, it seems that it would be appropriate for me to say kind of more loudly than most of the other speakers have, thanks to Rickard and Cato, I can't see Cato, for bringing us to this wonderful place, giving us the opportunity to do this excellent thing that we've been doing. This is going to be anticlimactic, what I'm going to do. But kind of on behalf of all of us, I think we owe them thanks. So my question is, maybe it should be May we conceive, meaning understanding, etc., as states of mind. If you know a paper by Warren Goldfarb called Wittgenstein on Understanding, you'll recognize the question. What Goldfarb does, at any rate at the beginning of the paper, is to attribute to Wittgenstein a nuanced or qualified negative answer, meaning understanding, etc., are in some sense not, and he puts the word definite in, which is supposed to help. But the qualification figures only at the beginning of Goldfarb's paper. He then goes on, I think this is fair, as if the thought that he's attributing to Wittgenstein is a flat no in response to the question. And what I'm going to do is to try to put in some of the qualification that isn't there. So I'm going to talk for a bit about why one might think that the answer that the investigation suggests to the question is no, and then a bit about why it's not that straightforward. So I'm simply going to be wallowing in some more or less familiar passages in philosophical investigations. Okay, so why might one think the answer to the question, may we conceive, meaning understanding, etc., as states of mind. Why might one think that philosophical investigations' answer to that question is no? Maybe the most obvious passage is 154. Try not to think of understanding as a mental process at all, for that is the expression that confuses you. It says mental process in Anscombe's translation. Maybe it should be happening or occurrence. The German is Vorgang. What's going on around there in the text is that Wittgenstein is considering exclamations like, now I understand. Understanding seeming to be something that makes its appearance in a moment, as he puts it in 151. And this goes back to, one grasps the meaning of a word in a flash, 138. So it's, we might say, onsets of understanding, or at any rate, things that we might be tempted to think of as onsets of understanding at definite moments, that in that advice in 154 is advising us not to try to conceive as mental occurrences. But it would be a counterpart to that to be suspicious of the very idea of onsets of understanding, because that brings with it the idea that there sets in at these moments something that we can appropriately conceive as a mental state. So I'm taking it that when he says don't conceive understanding as it's expressed, when he says now I understand as a mental happening, it amounts to saying don't try not to conceive it as the onset of something. That's what confuses you. So why does it confuse us? Well, again, a bit about the context, very familiar. Around here, Wittgenstein is considering a temptation to conceive, say, understanding a number series, or curiously, knowing the ABC, as, I quote, 149, a state of a mental apparatus, perhaps of the brain, by means of which we explain the manifestations of that knowledge. Or again, 146, the understanding itself is a state which is the source of the correct use. About that idea, Wittgenstein remarks, 146 still, what is one thinking of here? Isn't one thinking of the derivation of a series from its algebraic formula, or at least of something analogous? But this is where we were before. The point is, we can think of more than one application of an algebraic formula. And every type of application can in turn be formulated algebraically. But naturally, this does not get us any further. The application is still a criterion of understanding. The suggestion there is that when one thinks of the understanding of a number series as a state from which the correct use flows, one's picturing the state as an embodiment of an algebraic formula, or maybe one should say enmindment in some suitable medium. Considered as a mere piece of notation, a formula stands there like a signpost, that's 85. That is, it stands there like a thing that's in fact a signpost, but considered in abstraction from what it means in people's use of it, in abstraction from its pointing the way. Maybe considered just as a board, configured in a certain way, fixed on a post. Like a signpost considered like that, a formula considered like that, is normatively inert. These items, signposts, formulae, don't themselves sort behavior into what accords with them, so writing down the right numbers in the right order, or going in the right direction, and what doesn't accord with that. So now, suppose one tries to conceive understanding a series as an embodiment of a formula in a suitable medium. Given that the formula itself is normatively inert, that ensures that over and above the statement's picturing, there needs to be something that selects a specific interpretation of the formula that the state embodies. If we're to have in view something in the light of which what the person does, purportedly extending the series, is correct, or maybe incorrect if she makes mistakes. So an embodiment of a formula conceived on these lines couldn't contain within itself resources to determine which numbers it's correct to write if one's to extend the series, of whose principle the state is supposed to constitute an understanding. This is our attempt to picture a state that would be understanding the series. And that's made vivid in this context by Wittgenstein's remark in 149 that the criterion for the presence of this pictured apparatus ought to be, now I quote, a knowledge of the construction of the apparatus, quite apart from what it does. If we conceive the state that we're trying to picture like that, then it can't be the state itself, but that which we were hoping to see as the person's understanding of the series, in the light of which the numbers that the person writes down are correct or not. I hope that's all really quite familiar. Now, an inchoate appreciation of that sort of consideration, the sort of consideration I've just quickly sketched, which is obviously bringing in the considerations that come to a head in passages like 201, an inchoate appreciation of that, combined with an attempt to hold on to the picture of the understanding as the source of the correct use, with some dim appreciation of the idea that a criterion for a mental apparatus ought to be independent of what flows from it, leads to trouble. What we get is, seems to be a very good case of a crossing of pictures, a bit of Wittgenstein jargon. So we try to put together the idea of something for which there ought to be a criterion independent of what the person does, with the idea of something in the light of which what the person does is correct or incorrect if she makes a mistake. And that generates a picture of what one acquires when one grasps a sense or when one comes to understand the principle of a series as something that determines the future use in a queer way, not causally, or at any rate, not by way of any ordinary causation. This flowing is not ordinary causation. But it gets to look as if we have to say something like magically, something in which, in a queer way, the use itself is in some sense present. That's obviously partly quoting from 195. And in a way, I should just remark, in a way that appeal to something like magic, the appeal to something very weird going on, is something like the point, if we fall into thinking like that, in a way that I think is already expressed early on in the Blue Book, page 5, remark from there. It was in fact just the occult character of the mental process which you needed for your purposes. I mean, the purposes are the purposes I've tried quickly to sketch in terms of a crossing of pictures, an attempt to hold on to a certain conception of the mental apparatus from which actions flow, while combining that with an appreciation of the idea that what we want is something in the light of which what the person does stands revealed as correct, or if mistaken, then incorrect. So exclamations like "Now I understand," initial segment of a series given "Now I understand," make it look as if, I quoted this before, understanding is something that makes its appearance in a moment. That's 151. And straight after saying that, Wittgenstein goes on, so let us try and see what it is that makes its appearance here in this moment when it's appropriate to say now I understand. And given the thoughts I've just quickly sketched, it's quite predictable. It's quite predictable, given what we've seen about the requirements that we're shaping up to putting on this pictured state of understanding, that nothing that shows up in consciousness at the relevant moments is sufficiently weird, sufficiently peculiar, sufficiently such that we could attribute to it that quasi-magical power to satisfy the felt need. I mean, the kind of thing that we come up with is a form that is appearing to one. That's not it. So at this point, again, I'm a familiar rehearsal of things that go on right here in the text. We fall into conceiving the happenings that we find when we ask ourselves what makes its appearance in consciousness at the relevant moments. And for instance, a form is occurring to someone. We fall into conceiving those as accompaniments of the thing that we're really looking for. The understanding itself, we think, must be hidden behind these episodes of consciousness, must be still needing to be looked for. But when we give that idea a little further thought, it stands revealed as a dead end. A quote from 153. How can the process of understanding, again, happening, right, this supposed happening that is the onset of understanding, how can that have been hidden when I said, now I understand, because I understood? And if I say it's hidden, then how do I know what I have to look for? I am in a muddle. And it's there, it's in that predicament. I mean, having got to there, that was 153, that Wittgenstein issues the advice that I started with 154, try to stop looking for a mental happening that is the happening that you announce when you say, now I understand. Instead, he suggests, now this is still 154, ask yourself in what sort of case, in what kind of circumstances do we say, now I know how to go on, when that is the formula has occurred to one. So the formula is occurring to one didn't seem to be it. Don't look for something else that is it. Just ask yourself in what kind of circumstances it's correct to say, now I know how to go on. So we should remind ourselves of how these expressions, now I understand, now I know how to go on, are used. And the idea is that will disabuse us of this felt need to look for an occurrence in consciousness that such an utterance can be understood to report. Then there comes the interpolated discussion of reading, after which he comes back to the main line of his reflections, the ones I'm quickly rehearsing here, suggesting a positive alternative to supposing that these exclamations, now I understand, now I can go on, announce the occurrence of a mental process, a mental happening, announce the onset of the mental state. He describes a case in which the only thing that occurs in the consciousness of a person who says, now I know how to go on, after being shown an initial segment of the number series, is, his words, a feeling of relief. And the person then goes on with the series. And Wittgenstein says, this is 179 now, and in this case too, we should say, in certain circumstances, that he did know how to go on. By this point, we're on guard against the temptation to say the onset of the understanding is a happening hidden behind, in this case, the feeling of relief, and that's now standing in the position that the formula is occurring to one, stands in the earlier discussion. And now he says, this is 180, this is how these words are used, that's emphasized. It would be quite misleading in this last case, that is the case where there's the feeling of relief, the person says, now I can go on, and goes on. It would be quite misleading in this last case, for instance, to call the words a description of a mental state. One might rather call them a signal, and we judge whether it was rightly employed by what he goes on to do. There's something to the same effect in 323, I'll just mention this, in a context in which Wittgenstein is somehow doing the same thing again, again discouraging the question, what happens when a man suddenly understands? That's from 321. And then in 323, in the course of discouraging even asking that question. He says, "Now I know how to go on" is an exclamation. It corresponds to an instinctive sound, a glad start. I'm going to put that in together with signal in 180. So we have here a suggested partial account of how the words are used, what we learn to do with forms of words like "now I understand." We learn to use them as a signal. We learn to use them in contexts in which an instinctive sound and glad start might have been equally appropriate or something like that. And this story is surely, clearly, intended to be as far away as you could possibly get from an idea of describing mental states, announcing onsets of mental states, saying how things are in some peculiar region of reality. So I'm speculating about Goldfarb, but it seems fairly obvious that it's that kind of thing that he's working with. That's the seeming case for saying, look, what Wittgenstein's doing in philosophical investigations is discouraging taking "now I understand" in those circumstances as announcing the onset of a mental state. Try to avoid that, because it confuses you, and I've given a quick sketch of the kind of confusion that it leads to. But now the "on the other hand" bit, that's not the whole of the story. I'm now going to go to other parts of Wittgenstein's text, in which I want to read him as, in effect, showing us how a picture of meaning, understanding, and so forth, as states of mind, definite states of mind, Goldfarb's wording, if it makes any difference, can, after all, be quite innocent. And what I want to talk about is the last few pages of part one of the investigations, where Wittgenstein comes back to self-ascriptions of understanding, meaning, intention. Those are all pretty closely connected with where we've been. Also, thoughts, wishes, expectations, and so forth, which we have been enabled to see by things that happen eventually in the 400s, as more of the same issues arise here. So he goes back to these self-ascriptions, but now with a new twist, in that very often now his concern is with saying, for instance, what one meant at some time in the past. So the situations in which forms of words are in the present tense appropriate and shoved back into the past, and he talks about that. So, for instance, 666, familiar case. The case is one in which one is in pain and at the same time bothered by the sound of a piano being tuned, and one says, "It'll soon stop." And he says there in 666, "It certainly makes quite a difference whether you mean the pain or the piano tuning." That's the thing is happening now, right? The pain is present and the sound of the piano tuning is bothering one now. But in 682, this setup, including one saying "it will soon stop," has receded into the past. And we get the question, were you thinking of the noise or of your pain? And I think one might equally well have the topic of 682 be, did you need the noise or the pain? Parallel questions arise about the ability to say what one was going to say when one's been interrupted in the midst of saying something. So this is an intention that's receded into the past. He talks about that in 633 and around there. And at 660, I'm darting around a bit, but it's okay. It's not as arranged as the rest of the text, this last few pages of part one. At 660, he brings into play as requiring parallel treatment to the ability to say what one was going to say a past tense counterpart to the exclamation "now I can go on," which was the topic of those passages in the 150s. I quote from 660. "The grammar of the expression 'I was then going to say' is related to that of the expression 'I could then have gone on.'" So we're obviously meant to think about a case where at the time, one might have said, "I can go on, now I've got it, and now I understand." And then maybe one was interrupted, show me, and something came up. And when the time comes to show that one had got it, one's forgotten. I could then have gone on, but I can't now because I forgot what I got. So the grammar of the expression, I was then going to say, it's related to that of the expression that could then have gone on. In the one case, I remember an intention. In the other, I remember having understood. That's all from 6.6.6. In the one case, I remember an intention. In the other, I remember having understood. Okay, so that's a phenomenon about these passages. In a lot of them, he shifts to a retrospect over the occasions that he's been thinking about in, as here and now, in those passages in the 150s. And that already, by itself, complicates the picture a fair bit. I mean, it's an obvious thought. Instinctive sounds are bad starts. Ideas that he wanted us to see as models for these uses of language. But those surely don't have past tense forms. And there's no past tense counterpart to a sigh of relief. So the idea of a signal as a clear contrast to the idea of describing a state of mind, which was what seemed to be the role of that idea, no longer seems appropriate once we take note of this plain fact, which he's taking note of here, the fact that self-ascriptions of understanding and so forth, meaning, intention, thoughts, wishes, expectations, you name it, because they're now all in play as raising the same issues, that all these self-ascriptions have past tense forms. One main thrust of Wittgenstein's reflections around here is in line with the thought expressed at 154, where he issues the advice to try and stop thinking of thinking in terms of a mental happening. So this thrust is that we should be focusing on the circumstances in which words are used, rather than looking for an inner happening that we could, as it were, point to in order to explain what the words mean. So, 654, for instance, he writes, a mistake is to look for an explanation where we ought to look at what happens as a proto-phenomenon. That is, where we ought to have said, and now emphasis, this language game is vague. And that strikes me as a clear echo of 180, which I quoted before. This is how these words are used, such a 180. And again, same sentiment, 655. The question is not one of explaining a language game by means of our experiences, trying to point to an inner thing that is what the language game is on about, but of noting a language game. Let's do more than just note it, talk a bit about how it's played. Suppose we ask what state or happening in the mind is alluded to by saying something like, at that point I intended to say such and such, but I was interrupted. Or at that point I understood the series, but then maybe I lost it. Suppose we ask that, what state or happening in the mind is alluded to here? If we take a question like that as a request for something that would explain the language game of saying such things, it's obviously no good citing one's intention to say such and such. That's what was there in my mind then. Or the onset of one's understanding of the series. That's what came into my mind there, the understanding of the series. I mean, if the request is a request for an explanation of the language game of so much as saying these things, I mean, invoking the intention to say such and such, or the onset of understanding of the series, would just be making moves within the language game. It wouldn't be stepping outside the language game in order to explain it by pointing to its subject matter. Suppose we hold on to an explanatory aspiration on those lines, to explain the language game, rather than just as he advises us to note it. And equipped with that explanatory aspiration, search the contents of our memories of the relevant moments. I was going to say such and such. At that moment, I understood. Looking for something that isn't ruled out by the explanatory aspiration. What we're allowed to find in our memories, if we're not allowed to cite the intention or the onset of the understanding, as we're not, if this is what we're engaged in, is incapable of discharging the explanatory need. And we get happening here, something that's reminiscent of what happened when we searched the contents of our consciousness at the relevant moments. This is what we're doing it in memory, in passages like 151 and the passages that come after that, with, as I think we can now see, a parallel restriction in force. So in those earlier passages, the result was a temptation to suppose that the state of understanding itself or maybe the onset of the state of understanding, was something hidden behind the occurrences to which our attention was restricted by the fact that we were looking for something that we could use to explain the language game. Here, where we're searching our memories, the result is a temptation to suppose that if one can answer the question, what one was going to say when one was interrupted, pick one of Wittgenstein's instances and stay with it, that's because one interprets some fragmentary materials that are all we can suppose memory yields. And it's right, that fragmentary materials are all we can suppose memory yields. If, when we say what memory yields, we're restricted by this ambition of explaining the language game. So the restriction makes it look as if what memory yields is limited in a way that Wittgenstein describes in 6.3.5. He's talking here about, I was going to say, it puts that at the beginning, I was going to say, dot, dot, dot. You remember various details, but not even all of them together show your intention. It's as if a snapshot of a scene had been taken, but only a few scattered details of it were to be seen. Here a hand, there a bit of a face or a hat. The rest is dark. And now it's as if we knew quite certainly what the whole picture represented, as if I could read the darkness. That's a really neat, I think, formulation of a puzzlement that one gets into if one's approaching the questions in the way that he's resisting it. It can look amazing that one can confidently say what one was going to say, if it's right that all that one finds when one searches one's memory of the occasion when one was going to say something stands to the claim that one's going to say that, only as this fragmentary photograph stands to a fully depicted scene. We get a temptation in this context to say that knowing what one was going to say must come from interpreting what one finds in one's memory, these fragmentary details. In those earlier passages, 150s, Wittgenstein unmasks as hopeless the picture in which the understanding itself is something hidden behind the fragmentary phenomena that are the most that one can find in the way of occurrences in the mind. If the onset of the understanding itself is excluded, that's not something you can count as finding. On the ground that citing it wouldn't be a contribution to explaining the language game, but would merely exploit the language game. What corresponds to that here in the 600s, this unmasking as hopeless of the picture of the understanding is behind, is that Wittgenstein firmly rejects this picture of what memory yields, only fragmentary details, and then by interpretation we arrive at, knowing what we were going to say, what memory yields when the time, sort of time that he was talking about in the 150s, has received into the past. So this is 6.3.4. When I continue the interrupted sentence and say that this was how I had been going to continue it, this is like following out a line of thought from brief notes, as a kind of concession to the picture of what memory yields as fragmentary. But then, good bit, then don't I interpret the notes? Was only one continuation possible in these circumstances? Of course not. But I did not choose between interpretations, that is when I said what I was going to say. I remembered that I was going to say this. That's the end of the bit that I quote from there. And you might remember 660, I quoted 660 earlier, where he says, in the one case I remember an intention, in the other I remember having understood. I remembered that I was going to say this. I remember the intention that I didn't get to execute. I remember having understood 660 talking about a case where an occasion on which I might say, now I understand, has receded into the past. If we stop restricting what we're allowed to find in memory of the past occurrence to something that we could cite to explain from outside the language game that includes now I understand, and we now see its past tense counterpart, we make it possible to acknowledge that what we recall as having happened at the time includes not just those fragmentary details, maybe having a formula occur to one, having felt a sense of relief, something like that, but the onset of the understanding itself. what we're able to remember having happened at the time depends in part on which language games, of a sort that include provision for past tense utterances that give expression to memory, we are competent in. Learning the language game that includes now I understand and we now see its past tense counterpart gives us a new possibility of saying straight off, without needing to interpret what we can recall, how it was with us on suitable past occasions. That's a kind of gloss on what he's doing and saying, I remember having intended to say this, I remember having understood. That's the past tense version of the thought. Surely, in just the same way, the present tense regions of the language game can be seen as yielding new possibilities of saying, straight off, how it is with us on suitable present occasions. When we say what makes its appearance on an occasion when our command of the language game enables us to say, now I understand, we aren't restricted to occurrences we could conceive as there in our consciousness anyway, independently of our command of this language game, so that we might hope to appeal to their presence in order to explain what it is that moves in the language game to be correct. We can just exploit the language game, and it's no more than exploiting the language game to say that what makes its appearance in the moment on these occasions is the understanding itself. What happens is that the understanding sets in, a perfectly okay thing to say from inside the language game. In a discussion of saying what one meant by some past utterance, Wittgenstein engages with this topic that I'm introducing here, how command of the language game makes a difference to what one has it in one to report. Present tense, past tense, it doesn't now matter once we see that the language games provide for both. So this is back to 682, where he goes back to the case where one is bothered both by pain and by the noise of piano tuning, and says it'll stop soon. 682, you said it'll stop soon. Were you thinking of the noise or of your pain? If he answers, I was thinking of the piano tuning, is he observing that the connection existed, or is he making it by means of those words? Can't I say both? If what he said was true, didn't the connection exist? And is he not, for all that, making one which did not exist? So, refusing to choose between observing that the connection existed and making a connection. Observing that the connection existed is maybe not the happiest choice of words here. It isn't by observation that one knows what one means or knows what one meant. But I think that's irrelevant to the point that Wittgenstein really wants to make in that passage. The real point is that one's having meant, say, the piano tuning, and that's what we get in the case, can be more than a shadow or reflection of one's saying that that's what one meant. It can be more than a connection that one effects by saying that. No doubt one does make a connection when one says one meant the piano tuning, if only the connection that the piano tuning becomes what one has said one meant. But Wittgenstein is anxious that that shouldn't seem to exclude the possibility of its being simply a fact that one meant the piano tuning. And then, if it is a fact, it's a fact whether one says so or not. 689 goes in part like this. I'm thinking of N, I'm speaking of N, that's giving us the topics. Present tense now, present past doesn't matter. But how do I speak of him? I say, for instance, I must go and see N today. But surely that's not enough. After all, when I say N, I might mean various people of this name. And then in double quotes, then there must surely be a further different connection between my talk and N, for otherwise I should still not have meant him, with heavy emphasis on capitals. And then a comment on that, certainly such a connection exists, only not as you imagine it, namely by means of a mental mechanism. That was all 689. If what's in one's mind when one says it'll stop soon, or when one speaks of someone, I'm thinking of N, I'm speaking of N, is limited to items that might be candidates for explaining the language game of saying what or whom one means or meant. Then, when one considers the connection implied by forms of words like I meant the piano tuning, or I mean N, one will seem to face a choice between supposing that the connection is put in place by one's actually saying what one means or meant, on the one hand, and picturing it as an actualization of an occult power of the mind, mental mechanisms, he says at the end of my quote from 689, on the other. But a space opens up between these options when we realize there need be nothing more to the connections existing than the fact that, in the cases that we're thinking about, I meant the piano tuning, and I mean N, are correct moves in a language game in which the protagonist of the examples is competent. It can be true in a given case that they would be correct moves, whether or not they're actually made. So if they are correct in that, we can understand them to report a connection that exists anyway, independently of their being made. Though, hasten to add, not independently of the subject being competent in the language game in which such moves are made. And all of that makes room for a much less hard line on the availability to us in this kind of context of the idea of describing mental states than is suggested by the passages I was considering before. Back to them, 180, I quoted 180, which I'm talking about now, I know how to go on, where he says it would be misleading in that connection to use the phrase description of a mental state. Contrast with that, 662, where about a case that's clearly parallel, though now it's in the past tense, he says, which is interesting, nuanced remark. One can now say that the words "I wanted N to come to me" describe the state of my mind at that time. And again, one may not say so. You can, you better not. What's going on there? Well, something like this, I think. One had better not say so if that's going to lead one to picture the described state of mind, supposedly described state of mind, as a setup in an occult mechanism. Remember 689, not as you imagine it, namely by means of a mental mechanism. But now we have a different way of picturing the state of mind that we can, after all, say that the words describe. We can see the state of mind of wanting N to come. Present tense I've shifted to, past tense would be just as good as past tense there. We can see the state of mind of wanting N to come as no more than what's correctly attributed by moves in a language game that we know how to play. And now the same goes for the state of mind of understanding the principle of the series. It becomes innocuous to use state of mind, onset of state of mind, etc., a source of talk in commenting on what's going on in this language. What I'm urging may come into sharper focus if I end by directing it against a certain tendency in the interpretation of Wittgenstein. I'm going to consider really explicit expression of this tendency in the writings of David Peirce. Crispin Wright would have done as well, except I couldn't find as neat and sort of sharp a formulation of the way of thinking that I want to set what I've been pushing at you against. So Peirce starts from a point that he puts like this, I quote, "According to Wittgenstein, the distinction between following a rule and violating it cannot be wholly independent of the difference between the way we find it natural to develop the series and other ways of developing it." End of quote. Distinction between doing it right and doing it wrong can't be wholly independent of the difference between what we find it natural to do and everything else. So far, so good. I mean, that seems undeniable. But what Peirce makes of the point is a whole lot less straightforward. According to Peirce, Wittgenstein's thought is that to follow a rule requires, over and above anything one gets into one's mind when one grasps the rule, maybe at one of these moments when one can correctly say, "Now I understand," requires over and above that, now Peirce's words, a contribution from the rule follower himself. The rule follower's mental equipment, Peirce's words, that is what the rule follower has at the moment when he correctly says, "Now I understand," gives only incomplete guidance, Peirce, as to what he's to do in the future when he gets to a certain point in extending the series. This incomplete guidance needs to be supplemented in what Peirce calls an unavoidable leap from language to the world by the rule follower's propensity to find it natural to write one number rather than another at the relevant point in the series. Nothing, again Peirce's words, genuinely contemporary in his mind can determine what he should write at some point in the future. One more quote from Peirce: "The correct solutions to his future problems is problem what to write now." He's got to 1,000. "The correct solutions to his future problems cannot possibly be contained in anything that's in his mind now." So you have the picture of your understanding giving partial guidance, but if that was all you had, you wouldn't know what to do. But that's okay, because what you find it natural to do takes over and helps you out. So the thought that Peirce's Wittgenstein is putting in question is that a present understanding, say of the principle of a number series, already determines what number is going to be correct to write when one gets to a certain point in extending the series. I've just started, I'm at 442, 444, and my understanding already determines what's going to be correct to write when I get to a point. Peirce's Wittgenstein is saying no to that. If there were no way to persuade oneself that one could make sense of that thought, except by picturing the current understanding as a setup in an occult mechanism, configuration in an occult medium, we ought indeed to have no truck with it, and bringing that out, surely one of Wittgenstein's main points. If that required us to give up the idea that one's understanding of the principle of a series is itself sufficient to determine what it's going to be correct to do, then it would indeed seem that we have to resort to something on the lines of Peirce's Wittgenstein's positive account, in which what one finds natural serves as a needed supplementation over and above the only partial guidance provided by what one acquires when one comes to understand the principle. But to attribute a thought on those lines to Wittgenstein is to miss the character of his objection to the idea of the occult mechanism. To echo Cora Diamond, it's to read his criticism of mythology or fantasy as if it were a rejection of the mythology as a false notion of how things are. Then it seems that the supposedly rejected false notion has to be replaced with a true one, and then it's really easy to suppose that the true notion must have something like the shape of the picture Peirce attributes to Wittgenstein. We take the words that express that picture, stick not in front, and this must be where Wittgenstein is going. But in fact, I think a palpable fact about Wittgenstein has no objection to supposing that what one acquires when one comes to understand the principle of the series, one's mental equipment as it stands at that time, already suffices to determine what it's going to be correct to write when one gets to some point that's yet far on into the future of the development of the series. Wittgenstein's objection is directed against falling into mythology, picturing this contemporary mental equipment that already suffices to determine what can be correct to write as a configuration in the occult medium of the mind. 195, which I partly quoted before, I think is very suggestive in this context. I'll quote some more of it now. "But I don't mean that what I do now in grasping a sense determines the future use causally and as a matter of experience, but that in a queer way, the use itself is in some sense present." That's all in double quotes. And then a response: "But of course it is, in some sense. Really, the only thing wrong with what you say is the expression, in a queer way. The rest is all right. And the sentence only seems queer when one imagines a different language game for it from the one in which we actually use it." So the reassuring response there is saying, fine, present understanding determines the future use. Just don't fall into thinking that something magical has to be being affirmed when you say something like that. Of course, it's true that what we find natural primitively and what we can be induced to find natural by being suitably schooled are an essential element in an account of the language game of saying things like, "Now I understand," in particular of how this language game is viable at all. But the point isn't, as Peirce has it, that our propensities to find things natural help out our understanding, which gives only incomplete guidance, when we need to decide what to do. The point is rather something like this, that our propensities to find things natural are partly constitutive of what it is that we ascribe to ourselves when we say, exercising our competence in this language game, "Now I understand." It's no more than taking the language game seriously to rephrase that like this: our propensities to find things natural are partly constituted of the identity of the definite, Goldfarb's word, the definite state that we come to be in when we come to understand the principle of a series. That's a state that sets in its entirety at the relevant moments, an estate in the light of which it's completely settled what number it's correct to write when one reaches a certain point in extending the series. Thanks for listening patiently.